Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
One of the greatest things about our Football by Numbers series is having these great experts on, some great friends that I've developed that know a lot about football. Larry Schmidt's one of them. He talked about with number ones with us. He was on a bunch of the different programs. Well, he talks about jersey number 7 with us in this episode and all the great players that played with that number on.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Pigpen, we are glad once again to have Larry Schmidt of the Gridiron Uniform Database and Big Blue Interactive with us. And since I think this might be the third time you hear his voice on this podcast, maybe we can put him as a contributor to the Pigskin Dispatch podcast too. Larry Schmidt, welcome once again to the Pigpen.
Thank you for having me back, Darren.
Well, we're sure glad that you were able to come back with us. Today, Larry, we are still in our journey going the Football by Numbers series is what we're calling it. And we are all the way up to the jersey number 7 and all the greats that have wore that jersey throughout the NFL history. So we have 100 years to choose from. Where do you want to start off here? We have 7 Hall of Famers, I guess, and we're going to try to come up with a sort of our dirty dozen, the 12 best, most substantial players that have ever wore the number 7 in the NFL. So maybe I guess we
Hall of Famers, and we have, I think we have 5 or 6 guys who have had their number 7 retired by their respective teams.
I believe you're right. So I guess let's start off with the obvious choices. We'll go off with the 7 Hall of Famers. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
All right. Where would you like to kick off at with those Hall of Famers?
Well, we can start with chronologically the man whose fingerprints are all over the NFL as a player, a coach, an owner. He was there at the Hupmobile showroom in Canton when the NFL was, or the APFA was formed, George Halas.
Absolutely.
Wore the number 7. And he's in the Hall of Fame. And his, you know, interestingly, when I was going through my research, you know, the Bears retired number 7 in George Halas's honor. But as I went through the list, and, not to jump ahead, but Ed Sprinkle also wore number 7. And I remember Bob Avellini, you know, watching football in the 70s and early 80s, Bob Avellini also wore number 7 for the Bears. So obviously was retired posthumously for Mr. Halas.
I guess so. Or it was like sort of a Brett Favre retirement where he kept retiring and coming back out with that number 7.
As a coach, yes, that's right, that's right. And, and he has the dual honor Hall of Fame, or triple honor Hall of Fame, number 7 retired, and he has his initials on the Bears sleeve as well, GSH.
Yeah, definitely an important figure in NFL history. Definitely should be in the Hall of Fame with the inaugural class of the Hall of Fame because of his contributions. What do we know about him as a player wearing the number 7?
Well, unfortunately, you know, statistics weren't kept when he played in the 1920s. He played from 1920 to 1928 as a player, coach, owner, you know, Mr. Everything. But he was not a large man to play end, but he was known as being an effective player on defense, and he was a hard hitter. And the only statistics we have on him, you know, we don't have rushing yards, number of receptions, receiving yards, but we, you know, the only thing we know about him are his touchdowns scored.
Right. And how many do you have for him on that?
He had 1 rushing, possibly on an end around, and he had 6 receiving, and he has 3 defensive scores to his credit, two fumble recoveries for a touchdown and also an interception. So he has 10. And he also, in 1922, kicked two extra points. Adding to his Mr. Do Everything. scored a touchdown and kicked the extra point. It doesn't get much better than that.
Well, he was a real Renaissance man of the gridiron, that is for sure. Well, yeah, he is definitely on our list of 12, I would say, being the Hall of Famer. And I think next, well, I'll let you take us in. You want to keep going chronologically. Go ahead and bring up our next candidate.
Next, we would have Mel Hine of the Giants.
Right. And I think this is one of a personal favorite of yours. This is one of those ones when I said, who would like to discuss the number sevens? Your hand went up right away. And I think this might be the gentleman you wanted to talk about.
Well, yep. He's, you know, one of the most legendary Giants. He held the record up until Eli Manning of the most seasons played as a Giant with 15. And that was, you know, most notable because he was a two-way player. He played offense and defense. He played from 1930 through 1945. And most people remember or they recognize Mel Hine as being the greatest center ever. But they don't. Very few people are aware of how effective of a defensive player he was. You know, he was a prototype linebacker for the time. They weren't true linebackers until the 1950s, but he played standing up. He didn't have a hand down on the ground. And I'm friends with a gentleman whose father, Hat Morin, played with Mel Hine, Mike Morin. He lives here in the same town as me.
Wow.
And he told me that his father said, Mel Hine was an impact player on defense, and he could change the course of a game playing defense, you know, much like, you know, Giant fans of, you know, my era, the 80s, remember Lawrence Taylor taking over a game on defense. He said Mel Hine could do the same thing in a game in the 30s and the 40s.
Well, that's impressive.
And through my research and reading game summaries in newspapers, you know, he's one of the few players who could tackle Bronco Nagurski of the Bears, who was this big hulking fullback who, when he played defense, played defensive tackle. That tells you how big he was. You know, Mel Hine could tackle him one-on-one, but he would also, you know, Hine had the speed and the agility, the athletic ability to cover the best receiver of his era, Don Hutson, on the outside. You know, Steve Hohen and the Giants. You know, Steve Owen, the head coach, the defensive genius who later invented the umbrella defense. The Giants had a lot of pretty good success against Don Hutson, keeping his receiving statistics down. And a lot of that was he would have Mel Hine cover him, you know, through the first half of his route, you know, coming off the line through the middle of the defense, and then he would pass him off to the safety almost in a sort of an early concept of what a zone defense would end up being.
You know, that's amazing to sit there and think about it. Okay, so you have a man that played center on offense, offensive lineman, a defensive lineman, covering the top wide receiver in the NFL at the time, all the under coverage. That's amazing.
And then dropping the pads to take on Bronco Nagurski.
right. Wow.
That's a pretty rare ability. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, a couple of years ago, the Giants had me down to their facility for some interviews, and you know, I was talking to the producer and the director, telling him how I would love to do some players like Mel Hine and Tuffy Lehmans, and, you know, because the show, it doesn't really go back further than the 50s, and they said, you know, the problem is footage. We don't have enough footage on these guys. It's hard to put, you know, it's fine, the way we're doing it on a podcast, but when people are watching television, they want to see highlights.
Right, you need the visual.
Yeah, there's very few. There's just some newsreel footage of, you know, just little short clips. And I guess that's why guys like George Halas and Mel Hine aren't as remembered because, you know, there's not that much that you get to see on NFL films highlights of them as a player. You know, everybody remembers George Halas as a coach, you know, wearing the fedora and the trench coat. And, you know, there's not enough footage of them as players. And to find out about them, you have to go through the old newspapers.
But
game summaries, and maybe you can find a photo here and there.
That's very true. One thing that's impressive that the NFL does recognize Hein for, he made the 50th, the 75th, and the 100th anniversary all-time teams. I mean, that's quite a feat right there to go back 100 years and you're still on the all-time team. Very substantial player.
Yeah, and in my research, I also learned that later on, Mel Hein was a coach at USC, and he was on the same staff with Al Davis, and he became good friends with Al Davis. And when Al Davis in the 60s took over the Raiders, his center was Jim Otto, you know, the all AFL center.
Right.
And Al Davis would show Otto film of Mel Hein from the 1930s and the 1940s, teaching him how to snap the ball accurately, how to come out of his stance and get into a block. He's showing him film from a player a generation before him.
That's quite the role model to have, I'll tell you.
Just last year, another friend of mine, John Birdie, he contributes the Giants' all-time roster for their media guide. And it was last April or May, he sent me an email when he was going through his data, and he was comparing it against the NFL encyclopedia. He came up short 3 games, you know, one of Mel Hein's claims to fame on the Giants website, in the media guide, on the Pro Football Hall of Fame website. You know, Mel Hein played every game. He never missed a game in his 15 years. So we said, Larry, you know, I need your help. You know, the Giants played 14 games in 1933. I only have Hein playing 12. And in 1936, they played 12 games. I only have him playing 11. And I'm like, how could this be? You know, my whole life, you know, Mel Hein played every game. He was a 60-minute guy. He never missed a game.
Right.
So I went into the newspapers, and I started in 1936. I figured I would work backward. And I was in November, and I started seeing these clips. They were AP clips that would be sent around the country. And it said, Mel Hein, center of the New York Giants, has missed only one game in 6 years. I'm like, okay. So I'd never, ever, ever heard this before, but here it is in multiple newspapers. In November, it was November 3rd, 1936. So I did my due diligence. I finished out, you know, the game programs, the box scores, all the summaries for 36. He did play every game, but it got very interesting when I got to 1933. It was November 19th. The Giants were playing the Bears at the Polo Grounds in New York. And, you know, typically you would expect 1933, Giants-Bears. It's a very, very physical game. The Giants ended up winning 3-0. But there was a report in the newspaper in the middle of the week that Mel Hein came out of that game a little banged up. You know, they didn't have injury reports, you know, probable, questionable. There was no specific mention of an injury. They just said he was banged up and he wasn't practicing. So on the next week, it was Sunday the 26th, they were playing the Packers at the Polo Grounds. And it's fortunate that the game was in New York because I have multiple newspapers that I can cross-reference with, the New York Times, the New York Daily News, the New York Herald Tribune. And in this case, I also used one of the Brooklyn newspapers, the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, because depending on the reporter and who is at the game, some guys, you know, they always list the starting lineup. Some would just take the 11 that they had listed at the program. Some guys would take who was actually on the field for the first snap of the game, which was fortunate, so I could cross-reference them, because in this case, two guys used the program. They had Hein in there, but then the other two had the Giants' other center, and I'm like, oh, no, what happened? And I went through the substitutions, and Mel Hein sat the first half of this game against Green Bay, but he did enter in the third quarter. He played the second half, so he didn't have a start, but he had the game played.
That's some great due diligence there.
And then the Giants' next game, being Thanksgiving, it was on Thursday. It was a short week. They played the Brooklyn Dodgers at Ebbets Field in Brooklyn on the 30th. And being a short week, Hein couldn't go. he ended up not playing. And again, it was, I had to check multiple box scores. Hine didn't start, and he never entered the game. He wasn't listed in the substitutions. His next game played was December 3rd. They played the Pittsburgh Pirates at home at the Polo Grounds, and then Hine came back, finished out the season, played the championship game. So that was his one game missed. So when I got back in touch with my friend John, I said, all right, here's what I got. He did miss this game against the Dodgers on Thanksgiving in 1933. We had to let people know. So he had to let the Giants know, and the Giants, you know, I checked the Hall of Fame website this morning. They still haven't updated it. They still have him never missing a game. But the Giants corrected their media guide. They have Hine in a couple of places. They have his Hall of Fame bio, and they note that he did miss the one game. But because of that odd discrepancy in the Pro Football Encyclopedia, even though we had him missing a game, we increased his games played total by 2. Because they had it at 170, we actually increased him to 172 games played out of 173. So somehow when they put the NFL Encyclopedia together, it was in the early 1970s, somebody miscounted, and for 40-whatever years, almost 50 years, nobody caught it. So they were actually shorting him 3 games. We found he missed 1, but we increased his overall total by 2.
But I think he definitely deserves an asterisk by his name for that one game missed being on a short week of Thanksgiving.
That's right. Hey, Thursday football, it's never been a good idea.
Yeah, we don't like it now. They didn't like it then, that's for sure.
Hey, you know, it wasn't uncommon for teams to play 3 games in 7 days. The Giants played on Thanksgiving, but then they played 3 days later on Sunday. It's not like you play on Thursday and then you get, it's like a 10 days off. You just play 3 games in 7 days, or 3 games in 8 days. And you play both ways. You play defense, you play offense.
And then no
Sundays off.
That's incredible. Well, definitely Mel Hine is on our list there. That's definitely great research on your part. How about we talk about Mr. Bob Waterfield next? He's also in the Hall of Fame. What do you have on Bob Waterfield?
He played for the Cleveland and the Los Angeles Rams Hall of Fame. The Rams have his number 7 retired. He was a member of the 1946 Cleveland Rams NFL champions. They beat the Redskins that year on a frozen field. And in 1950, the Rams had a great year in Los Angeles, where they are still the highest scoring team in NFL history. They averaged just short of 39 points a game.
Wow.
Think of modern football with all the rules that favor offense and passing the ball. Here he was, about splitting time with Norm Van Brocklin, the two of them combined for nearly 40 points a game back in 1950, where you could hit the quarterback, you could mug receivers going down the field, and, you know, you could only imagine how many points per game they would have put up if they had today's rules back then in 1950.
Yeah, that's for sure. And to boot, he was married to Jane Russell for a while.
That's right. Hey, it's a good move for him going from Cleveland to Los Angeles, wasn't it?
Right, yeah. Miss Russell probably wouldn't want to live in the cold of the Midwest. Of Cleveland.
The weather's much nicer there in Hollywood.
I agree. Well, I say definitely Bob Waterfield on the list. Great athlete in the NFL. Who do we have next up on our Hall of Famers for number 7?
We have Dutch Clark.
Oh, yes.
Of the Portsmouth Spartans and then later the Detroit Lions. He might be the last true triple threat player. He could run, he could pass, and he could drop kick.
He's very interesting.
Like George Halas, although he kicked a lot more extra points than George Halas did. I think Dutch Clark led the NFL, he led the NFL in touchdowns scored 3 times, and he led the league in extra points 3 times as well. And he led the league in field goals once too, and he did it drop kicking. He was the last regular drop kicker. He played up through 1938. You know, by that point, the NFL started using the modern, more streamlined ball for passing since 1934. So still for, you know, 4 or 5 seasons, he was still drop kicking this ball that you know, in the 1920s and early 30s was more like a rugby ball. It was fatter, and you, you could drop it and boot it with a lot more accuracy. But
the old melon ball, they called it.
I think it was a big. I think Hallis called it a pumpkin.
The pumpkin. Yeah, they streamlined that to make it a little less girth, so a quarterback could get his fingers around the ball, get a little bit better spiral. So good move on the NFL's part.
Yeah, and Clark had a big game in the Lions' first championship in 1935 when they played the Giants. I'm just punching up that box score real quick just to make sure my memory isn't too fuzzy.
Yeah, he was part of that. It was the first postseason game in NFL history. Portsmouth actually, back then they had the NFL, the team with the best record was declared the champion. Portsmouth was percentage points ahead of Chicago. Mr. Hallis decided, hey, we can't have that. He challenged Portsmouth to a championship game, which ended up being played, and Chicago ended up winning. But yeah, Dutch Clark playing in that game.
Right. They had a lot of, change a lot of rules to fit them into Chicago Stadium. They had the inbounds lines and the goalposts, and when they crossed the 50-yard line, they would march the ball back. And they ended up, a lot of those rules became the rules in 1933 to help make the game more modern and more open.
Well, actually, you know what? Dutch was not able to play in that championship game, I recollect, because he was the head basketball coach of Colorado College, and his hoops team, which was his regular job, had a game that December 18th. He couldn't get off work to make for the very first NFL championship game.
Yeah, he was probably making more money coaching college basketball than playing professional football.
Absolutely, absolutely.
How changed. That's right. So Dutch Clark in 1935 in the championship game, he had 80 yards rushing and a touchdown and an extra point.
That's amazing.
Doing it all.
Yeah, definitely Dutch Clark on our list of some of the most substantial number sevens in NFL history. Who do you have up next for our number sevens of all time?
I have Clarence Ace Parker of the Brooklyn Dodgers and also the Boston Yanks and the New York Yankees of the All-America Conference, which is a little bit of a story in and of itself because that's still all one franchise.
Right.
Parker was started with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1937, and he was a do-it-all player. He was a leader. He was a passer. He was a rusher. He played strong defense, and he led. I think he was the NFL's MVP in 1940. And in 1940 and 1941, the Dodgers actually had a very, very strong team. They were contenders for the East. They finished second both years. And, you know, Parker was the guy on the team. And they were actually, during those couple of years, were actually considered in the New York area on the same plateau as the Giants, who were always, you know, the kings of football in New York.
Right. And he was another triple threat player back then.
He was.
Two-way player. Great, great ball player.
He was. He was probably the best player in New York at the time, you know, other than Mel Hine. But, you know, Mel Hine was the center. He was, you know, Parker was the ball handler. But then, you know, 1941, like many, many, many players, he had his football career interrupted by World War II, and he spent 3 years in the service. When he came back in 1945, when the war was over, because of the man shortage, they changed their name to the Tigers in 1944. In 1945, the Brooklyn Tigers merged with the Boston Yanks. So Parker was the quarterback for the Boston Yanks for one season. It was planned to just be a one-year merger, like the Pitt-Phil-Steagles and Card-Pitt. But the All-America Conference was being formed, and the owner of the Tigers decided he wanted to jump leagues and get involved with the All-America Conference. So when they unmerged in 1946, the Brooklyn Tigers became the New York Yankees of the All-America Conference with Parker as their quarterback. And the Yankees actually had a very good season. They won the East, and they played the Cleveland Browns in the first All-America Conference championship game.
You know, I've read an interesting story on that, why they end up changing from the NFL to the AFC. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but according to what I read, the Maras were upset because the Yankees wanted to play in just across the river in the stadium. Yeah, the Giants, that's part of their territory. You can't do that. You know, go back out to Brooklyn and play. You know, you're too close to our fan base. And the gentleman, I forget his name, who owned the Yankees at the time, decided, hey, well, forget it. We're going to join this other league so we can, you know,
That's right.
Would
have been an entry fee, which, you know, that, you know, this is, I don't want to get too much off topic, but that was a very, very, very expensive competition that, you know, the All-America Conference and the NFL had against each other, competing for players. Player salaries went way, way up, and this is right after the war. And, you know, Yankee Stadium was walking distance from the Polo Ground. You just walk right over the bridge across the Harlem River. And, you know, sometimes the two teams will be playing at the same time. And they're, you know, competing, you know, so the Giants' attendance goes down because some players go across the river to watch Ace Parker with the Yankees.
Jeez. That's an amazing time.
By jumping leagues, they don't have to pay an entry fee to the Giants because they're competing with the NFL. And it was, I can't remember the Brooklyn owner's name, but he had a very famous quote that I found in several of the newspapers where he claimed the NFL as being a racket by the Big Four, meaning the Giants, the Redskins, the Bears, and the Packers. He said the whole system is rigged. Nobody else gets a chance.
And that's part of what had Commissioner Burt Bell. That was what he used this as evidence of why to start the NFL draft, which we know is probably one of the greatest things that ever happened to the NFL. So, wow, great stories on Ace Parker, too. Huh? Definitely making our list here of our greatest number sevens. Who do we have next on our list?
We have our second number seven from the Bears, Ed Sprinkle.
Oh, yes.
He was a member of the true Monsters of the Midway. He was, he had the nickname the meanest man in pro football. So he put the monster in the Bears. He played from 1944 up through 1955, and he was on their one championship team in that stretch, which was 1946.
Wow, definitely a great player there too. He had four interceptions in his career. He had 32 career passes. Right, 32 career passes caught for 451 yards and seven touchdowns as a lineman.
He started in the single platoon era in the 1940s, and then he finished, you know, in the more modern era in the 1950s, where he was defense exclusively.
That's truly amazing. Oh boy. Okay. Well, I guess that's it for our older era players that were the number seven that made the Hall of Fame. But we have a couple more contemporary players that many of those listening probably got an opportunity to at least watch play on television. Show Morton Anderson and John Elway, number sevens.
Two more in the Hall of Fame.
Great.
And I think I mentioned last time when we were talking about number one, my affinity for left-footed kickers, Morton Anderson, was a left-footed kicker, and he started playing in 1982 when I was in high school and played all the way up through 2007.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And he's one of the very few players who's on more than one all-decade team. He's on the all-decade team for the 1980s and the 1990s. So not only was he playing for a long time, he was obviously a very, very effective player.
For 25 years. It's amazing you say that because, you know, 1982, I was just starting high school myself. And by the time his career ended in 2007, I had two of my children to graduate in high school by then. So
truly
a great career.
Yeah. And I know for the longest time, you know, again, last time when we were talking, about, you know, kickers and how records, you know, the accuracy just keeps going up and up and up and guys make 50 yarders, no problem. He was really the first one, like in the 1980s, could kick 50-plus yard field goals with better than expected accuracy. And he held the record for a very long time for field goal percentage. You know, it's since been passed by more recent players, but he held that record for a very, very long time.
You're absolutely right.
He did
right.
it with his left foot. He did it with his left foot.
Putting a different spin on the ball.
He was. One season for the Giants. He was the bulk of his career was the Saints. He started with the Saints, and then he played a long time for the Falcons. And then he bounced around a bit in his last couple of years.
Yeah, definitely a great player. Definitely deserving of being in the Hall of Fame and on our list of the greatest number sevens to play the game. Okay, now we get to sort of one that everybody knows, Mr. John Elway. What do you think about Elway?
I think he is, no question, one of the most unique players I've ever seen play the quarterback position. You know, I remember in the 1980s, you know, my Giants were on their way to their first Super Bowl, and I'm watching the highlights, and I'm watching this guy run this drive against the Cleveland Browns in Cleveland from their own 2-yard line. I'm like, oh, we got to play him again? Because the Giants played the Broncos in the regular season in Giants Stadium, and that was a really, really tough game. The Giants were, you know, that game was in question all the way till the end. They had a last-minute drive to kick a field goal to win. Elway, he could move and he could throw the ball farther than anyone I've ever seen on the, probably in, even including up till today. You know, he could run to the left sideline and throw a ball 50 yards downfield diagonally toward the right sideline and hit a guy between the numbers.
I just watched a program the other night. Peyton Manning has a program on ESPN+. He has called Peyton's Places, and he had John Elway on just a few weeks ago. And, you know, John Elway was Peyton Manning's boss for a few years when he was with Denver. And they talked about Elway's, that 98-yard, you know, the drive against Cleveland in the 1986 NFL championship game and what was going through Elway's mind. But they showed the replay of that famous pass, and I forget who his wide receiver was that did the slant route that he found open in the end zone when the linebacker pulled off on his back. But he, Elway threw that off balance and sidearmed and threw a powerful ball for that strike for the touchdown.
Yeah. I remember seeing him running and making those plays in that muddy jersey. I mean, he was tough. He was physically tough.
Yeah, a lot of hits.
And, yeah, it was Mark Jackson that he
Mark Jackson, you're correct. That's right. Yeah. They also talked about the infamous Elway cross, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
John Madden used to talk about that. You know, in practice, he would throw the ball so hard to receivers that, you know, the point on the ball would get embedded in the player's chest.
Matter of fact, Manning, just to show that Elway still had the arm strength here, you know, these many years later after his playing days are over, they had a gelatin, like ballistic dummy set up, and they had Elway throw a ball at him, you know, and the Elway cross was showing up on the gelatin man still to this day with Elway's arm strength. So great ball player, great baseball player, too. He could have had a great baseball career.
He had the mechanics, you know, he threw the ball with his whole body. He had, you know, he had those big legs. He almost had, like, you know, running back's legs, which was very, very unusual for when he came up in the 1980s. And he would, you know, his body mechanics, he would just get his whole body behind the throw. And I'm sure some of that came from his training of, you know, being on the pitcher's mound.
It's interesting you say that because Elway, in that the Peyton Manning episode, talked about when he was starting high school playing football. He played running back when he was younger in Little Gritters. And he's going to his first high school practice. His father, who was a coach, I believe, at the time, was driving him to practice and asked, you know, John, what position he's going to go out for? And John goes, oh, I'm going to be running back, of course. You know, that's a position I've been playing. And he said his dad pulled the car over, and 15 minutes later he got out of the car and said, hey, Coach, I want to be quarterback.
You can't waste that arm talent running the ball.
Right, center.
You got to deliver it.
And they showed footage of him in high school. You know, so this is, you know, late 70s. He's playing a spread formation, and he's probably 8-9 yards back in the shotgun formation, almost the position of a punter, playing the spread formation football in high school, which the NFL hadn't even really adopted yet at that point.
No, that was pretty rare. You know, I remember the Cowboys and the Buffalo Bills, they were the few teams that used the shotgun. Everybody was under center at that time.
Right. Okay, I think that we covered all seven of our Hall of Famers that were the number seven now. So now we want to try to get to that dozen. So we have to come up with five other names, and we have quite an array of folks to choose from. One that I want to bring up because he's from my team and currently still playing. Of course, we don't know about next year, but Ben Roethlisberger wearing number seven.
Speaking of big quarterbacks.
Yes, Big Ben. What do you have on Big Ben, if anything?
I have a lot. Big Ben, he's actually one of the few players on this list that I've actually seen play in person. I was at the last game of the regular season in 2004 when the Giants hosted the Steelers, and of course Eli Manning and Ben Roethlisberger came out of that very famous quarterback class that year.
Along with Philip Rivers that year.
And Philip Rivers.
Right.
And Big Ben is still going at it. Philip Rivers just played his last game, and, you know, like you mentioned, Ben, we're not sure yet. But he's, you know, he's led the, you know, still playing quality football. He had a big year last year, and Steelers won a lot of games, and he's led the NFL in passing yards twice, and he's been in three Super Bowls, and he came away the winner twice, and that's not a bad resume for someone who you and I think probably both agree will end up in the Hall of Fame one day.
I believe he will. He was a 2004 AP Rookie of the Year, has played in six Pro Bowls so far. I always like to look at that touchdowns to interceptions on quarterbacks, and so far in his career, 396 TDs, 200 interceptions, so almost a 2-1 touchdown to interception, which is pretty good for a quarterback, and he's thrown for just over 60,000 yards, which is another pretty dynamic statistic to look at. And he's, who knows, he's probably not done.
In all the categories, completions, yards, touchdowns, played in a bunch of playoff games, and he's won a couple of Super Bowls. And actually, one record that I remember also from that rookie season in 2004, Phil Simms in 1979 set, what turns out to be a very a modest record, but at the time, he won his first four consecutive starts as a rookie quarterback, and that record lasted until 2004 when the Steelers had a big year that year in 2004, and Roethlisberger won. They finished 15-1, and Roethlisberger, how many games was it? 13 in a row, or
I think he won all 15.
14.
Because the game that he lost was the game he came in. He came in against the Ravens. He didn't start that game, and I believe it was Tommy Maddox started the game. And that was their one loss during the season.
They were 1-1, so he won four. So he pushed the record from four wins to 14.
and one or two playoff.
Good luck for the next rookie to win 15 in a row.
and if you count one or two playoff games that they won, because they end up losing the AFC Championship game to New England that year, and a young Tom Brady.
Right, they beat the Jets. So he did get 15 in a row, but they only count, as 14 in a row in the regular season.
Right.
Yeah. That's not too bad for a rookie.
Not too bad at all. Not too bad. And if it is, we don't know, but if this past season was Roethlisberger's last season in the NFL, or last with the Steelers, they lost a bad heartbreaker to Cleveland. Yeah. The way a game got away from him real early. But he threw for over 500 yards at 38 years old. That's still a pretty impressive number. To bring them back.
He had the ice pack on that shoulder after the game.
He probably still has it on right now, a month or so later. Okay, there are a lot of other real good quarterbacks that are on this list, and I'm not sure if you have any in particular you want to bring up or you want me to mention one.
I have one guy who's really interesting. He had a very unusual career arc. Is Joe Theismann.
Oh yes.
He's a big-time quarterback for the Washington Redskins in the late 70s and the early 80s, and they are actually on that list of highest-scoring teams ever. The 1983 Redskins, they challenged that record by the 1950 Rams for a while. They came just a little bit short, but the 1983 Redskins averaged, it was 33.8 points per game. 1983. They were coming off a Super Bowl. They had beaten the Dolphins in the strike short year 1982 in the Super Bowl, and the 1983 Redskins were just a ridiculous football machine. They had a great year that year, and they were actually favored to beat the Raiders in the Super Bowl, but didn't quite work out that way. But
no.
The Redskins were 14-2, and they were just demolishing teams, and they beat the Rams in the divisional playoff 51-7, and then they played, you know, a classic game against the 49ers in RFK Stadium, an NFL championship game. But before Theismann became the quarterback, you know, he played at Notre Dame, and wasn't drafted in the NFL. He ended up playing a couple of years in Canada in the CFL, and including returning punts. He was just such a competitor, and he wanted to get on the field. And he was willing to do anything. He played 3 years in Canada. He was a punt returner. And then he joined Washington in 74, and he was the backup for a number of years before he took over. And, you know, you could see some of that skill that he had. You know, he was a running quarterback. He wasn't as big as guys like Elway and Roethlisberger. He was a small guy, but he would run, and he played with a single-bar face mask, and he wasn't shy about, you know, dropping his shoulder and fighting for extra yards as a runner, and he could throw the ball well, and he was, you know, one of the guys that I watched, you know, growing up. He was in the NFC East. I watched him twice a year against the Giants, and he was playing great games against the Cowboys and got to a couple of Super Bowls, played in Pro Bowls.
Yeah, probably one of the games against the Giants he regrets, because it sort of ended his career when Lawrence Taylor hit him on that vicious sack, and probably one of the most horrific plays that anybody could ever watch in football, with his leg going a couple different ways.
He was like a warrior. He was like one of the Roman gladiators. You know, they carried him off the battlefield on his shield. And, that was I remember watching that. That was a tough one.
I think it was a Monday night game, too, I believe.
It was. Yeah, it was a Monday night.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was a horrific injury. All right. He's definitely under consideration. I have another person that you probably watched in the 70s that was in the AFC East, Ron Jaworski, were number seven.
And unlike Joe Theismann, Ron Jaworski was not known as a runner.
No,
he was a classic drop back, throw the ball from the pocket. But he was a very, very intelligent player. He was a guy who could read a defense, and he would, you know, go through his progressions, and he would deliver the ball in the right place at the right time to the right guy. And he was a tremendous leader, and, you know, the Eagles had struggled through much of the 70s, and it was, you know, in the later 70s when Dick Vermeil took over, Ron Jaworski was the quarterback, and they started to climb back, and they made the playoffs several years in a row, and they had that big year in 1980 where again, they were favored to beat the Raiders in the Super Bowl, and it didn't quite work out that way.
Yeah, I think the Raiders liked playing
the way of beating the NFC East teams in the Super Bowl.
I was just going to say that.
the Eagles, they were 12-4. I remember they had a big, big win against the Cowboys at the Vet in the NFC Championship game. It was freezing cold, and the Eagles wore white jerseys to force the Cowboys to wear blue. And, you know, they had a big game, and they went to the Super Bowl with a lot of momentum. But, you know, that didn't take away from Ron Jaworski's year. That was his first Pro Bowl season in 1980.
You know, there's a lot of parallels between Theismann and Jaworski's, besides both playing in, opposing teams in the NFC East. But, again, if I look at that, a couple of different statistics, which this kind of surprised me, because I thought them to be pretty much equal as far as starting quarterbacks. But Theismann, his touchdowns, he had 160 touchdowns to 138 interceptions. Jaworski was 179 TDs to 164 interceptions. I didn't remember Jaworski throwing that many interceptions, but obviously he did record.
Well, that was just the style of football at the time. It was not abnormal for quarterbacks to have higher interception totals. You know, it was Bill Walsh with his West Coast offense with the 49ers that really reduced that interception. You know, always have a safety valve, always have a place for the quarterback to deliver the ball when he's in trouble. You know, the offenses prior to Bill Walsh were more vertical, you know, throw the ball downfield. And coaches would tell their passers, you know, don't be shy about throwing into coverage, you know, make the play. And, you know, if you're going to throw in, make a mistake, make it deep. You know, a long interception is almost as good as a punt. So it was just a different mentality. And a quarterback, say, throwing 20 touchdowns in a season with 16 or 17 or 18 interceptions wasn't uncommon. You know, today you'd be horrified, like, oh, my God, he's killing my fantasy team. He's throwing touchdowns, but look at all these interceptions. That it was just different back then. And, you know, defenses were able to play against receivers. You know, you could they had the five-yard chuck rule, but still you would see guys running downfield with hand-checking and contact, and quarterbacks were allowed to get drilled in the pocket. You know, you'd release the ball, and a guy could still take a couple of steps and slam you, and that was just good football. It was just a different era.
Yeah, the other thing that sort of surprised me was his overall, Jaworski's overall record was only four games over 500. That shows you some of the teams that were struggling of the Eagles in those early 70s before Vermeil got there.
Yeah, he was part of the turnaround, but you know, those strong teams they had in the late 70s and there, you know, 1980, 81, they were in the playoffs, and he was the guy. He was, you know, the reason that they had those successful seasons.
He was part of the
growing process.
Definitely, and you can tell even to this day, you see some of Jaworski's film study of current players. It's just, he does a great job of breaking down
he's been
film.
Doing that forever. You know, like Madden, there's a generation of football fans who knew Madden as the guy with the telestrator broadcasting games, and there's a generation of fans that know Jaworski as the guy on the, you know, the on ESPN doing the NFL matchup with the same stuff with the diagrams and breaking down plays in real time for everybody. You know, that was, he was very, very, very intelligent. He was an excellent player.
All right. And I have a few other quarterbacks that I think probably ought to talk about. Well, we have another one that played in the Super Bowl, Boomer Esiason. And
yes,
I'm not sure.
He played in one of the great Super Bowls of the 80s. It was 1988.
Yes.
That was the year that the Bengals had there. It wasn't a hurry-up offense, but it wasn't a no-huddle. But it was before Jim Kelly and the Bills had the K-gun, because they played the Bills in the playoffs, and that's what gave Marv Levy that idea. But they were, you know, rush up to the line, call the play at the line, and, you know, Boomer Esiason, another intelligent player who could read the defense pre-snap, and then after the snap he would go through his progressions and deliver the ball to the right guy at the right time. And they darn near won that Super Bowl, but, you know, I'm sure when you get to number 16 in a week or two, you'll be talking about Joe Montana, but that's a whole other story.
Right, right.
They were a very, very prolific offense, the Bengals under Esiason.
But here's his stats: 247 touchdowns, 184 interceptions. Not a bad ratio there. But his win loss as a starter, 80-93, under 500, and it sort of shows.
Yeah. Well, later in his career, he had a couple of rough seasons with the Jets, and then he went to the Cardinals. I'm sure his record with Cincinnati is above 500.
One game over 500, 62-61 with the Bengals, 15-27 with the Jets, and 3-5 with the Cardinals.
Yeah.
But again, an interesting one to talk about, because he did take a team to a Super Bowl.
He did.
Yes. Now, I have a quarterback that I really enjoyed watching when I was younger in the 70s, and that's Burt Jones, played for the Colts. I thought he was an interesting quarterback to watch in that sort of in that post Unitas era of the Baltimore Colts. They're looking for a thrower.
He was a great quarterback, and he a lot of arm talent. He was a great thrower of the football with mechanics, and he had a strong arm and he was accurate. You know, unfortunately, his career was shortened by injury.
Yes.
When he was with the Rams, I believe.
Yeah, he played his last season with the Rams. Nine with the Baltimore Colts and one with the Rams. 124 touchdowns in his career, 101 interceptions, had an overall record of 47-49. With the Colts, he was dead even 46-46.
Yeah, they had he had a lot of good teams in Baltimore, but then toward the end there in the early 80s, they were declining, and they wanted to get younger when they sent him to Los Angeles, and then he had his injury that unfortunately ended his career.
Yeah, and he was a first-team All-Pro and MVP of the NFL Ice Show, too. I'm not sure. I think that must have been 1976, possibly. So, yeah, very interesting player, number 7, for the Baltimore Colts. Another interesting quarterback I have on this list is Mr. Randall Cunningham of the Eagles, another Eagles quarterback that wore 7.
Hey, didn't we talk about him? He also wore number 1.
I think you're right. Yeah, we did. Your last time you were on.
A couple of different teams, a couple of different numbers, so he's going to show up a lot.
Right, and so probably his best number is number 12.
He wore 7 with the Vikings, am I correct?
Yeah, three seasons with the Vikings and 1 with Dallas, he wore number 7.
Yeah, and he was with Minnesota throwing the ball to Randy Moss's rookie season.
Yes, he was.
Those high arcing passes to that tall, skinny leg receiver downfield.
Randy Moss, first starter.
Majority of those 50-50 balls.
Right. That is definitely right. But, yeah, he was probably his better years were wearing the number 12 with the Eagles, except for, you know, like I said, those Vikings years. He did have some good years there, too. But definitely somebody to put a name in there to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Another name that I had is we have Ken O'Brien wore the number 7 for about 9-10 seasons with the Jets, I believe.
Yeah, he had a couple of really good years in the mid-80s, 1985, 1986. You know, he had some very famous quarterback duels with Dan Marino. You know, they had that game in 1986 that he threw 4 touchdown passes all to Wesley Walker. I think both quarterbacks threw for over 500 yards that day. You know, the Jets won in overtime. It was something like 51-45. But anytime, you know, in the middle 80s when the Jets and the Dolphins were playing, you knew there was going to be balls in the air and a lot of points on the scoreboard.
Yeah, oh, you know, and something I failed to mention with Cunningham, he had, I mean, I thought this was a pretty great stat, 207 touchdowns, 134 interceptions. So he took care of the ball better than I remembered him doing, plus all the yardage he gained on the ground with his legs, you know, phenomenal.
Right.
And O'Brien ended up having 128 touchdowns in his 10-year career and 98 interceptions for that. So definitely some names to consider there. And let's see, Michael Vick wearing the number 7. Probably his best years, you know, were Atlanta and with the Eagles, and he wore the number 7 with both those teams.
Yeah, and he had a 1,000-yard rushing season.
Yes, he did.
Are they probably the only quarterback of the modern era? You know, first guy since, like, you know, I don't know how many quarterbacks in the 1940s were running for 1,000 and throwing for 1,000, but that's certainly a rare feat.
Definitely is. And for his stats, he had 133 career touchdowns, 88 interceptions, a record of 61-51. Definitely a much better record than I remember. I guess his sort of tainted after his years absent from the league for some things we won't mention because we're positive football here. We don't want to talk about that. But he came back, wasn't quite the player he was before that run-in he had. The other player I had that I think that you'd like to talk about is Elmer Angstman.
All right, going 7. Way back.
Yes.
Chicago Cardinals.
Absolutely.
So he probably has one of the most eye-catching box scores for a championship game in history. You know, the last time the Cardinals won the NFL title was 1947, you know, in Comiskey Park against the Eagles. They beat the Eagles 28-21. Angstman had 2 70-yard rushing touchdowns in that game, you know, including one in the fourth quarter that proved to be the game winner. It put the Cardinals up 28-14, and they ended up winning 28-21. But for the game, Angstman had 10 carries for 159 yards.
Wow.
Two touchdowns, including the game winner. So that's a big game performance right there. 16 yards a carry and two touchdowns.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple other more modern-day quarterbacks. Well, this one's another one from the 70s. Dan Pastorini wore number 7 with the Oilers, and he had a year in Oakland where he wore number 7. So that's the majority of his career. 10 of his 12 years wearing number 7. He ended up having his touchdown to interception ratio, not that great. 103 touchdowns, 161 interceptions. So didn't really care for the ball.
A lot of that is just 1970s football.
Right. Of course, when you have Earl Campbell.
Not alone.
Yeah. Earl Campbell standing behind you certainly takes some pressure off your statistics, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he played a lot of years before Earl Campbell was on the team, but I'm sure Earl made his job a lot easier once he arrived.
Most definitely. Most definitely. Another one I have is Doug Flutie, who's sort of an interesting didn't wear number 7 long. He wore with the Buffalo Bills and with San Diego Chargers.
Yeah, and another guy who actually he had big years in the middle of his career. He left the NFL for Canada, and he's in the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, and I believe he's pretty universally regarded as the best player in CFL history.
Really, over Warren Moon?
I think so. Yes, I think so.
Really?
I saw an NFL Films feature on Flutie a few years ago, and they had a lot of guys from Canada, general managers, and players and coaches. And I think in north of the border in Canada, there's a lot of regard for Doug Flutie. They like him up there. All the CFL fans.
Well, we had a friend of mine, Oz Davis, on discussing the number 2s, and Flutie also wore the number 2 on his jersey. And Oz is really enjoys the CFL game. He's very knowledgeable about the CFL, and he talked quite a bit about that too with Flutie and the CFL career and his NFL career. And he ended up making our top 5 list for the number 2 players. So, yeah, very very interesting player there. I have one other one that I wanted to mention. Actually, two other ones. We have Colin Kaepernick, who played in the Super Bowl, who wore the number 7, an interesting and controversial figure.
Yeah, another running quarterback.
Yes, used his legs well. Was really, when he played for San Francisco, was just a real threat. You know, you didn't know what to do if you were a defender. You know, you didn't want to leave him, because he was pretty good with his arm, too, that those couple seasons he had that were really outstanding. And another one is a Craig Morton, who is a longtime player in the NFL, didn't wear 7 for very long. Most of the time he was a 14, but with Denver, when he probably had some of his greatest seasons near the end of his career, he was a number 7 for Denver.
That's
before
right.
Joe Kelly.
He made a Super Bowl in that number 7, because he spent three years with the Giants, he wore 15. Well, they got him midway in the 1974 season. He was 15. He came from Dallas, and then the Giants traded him to Denver, and then he went on to a Super Bowl.
Yes, he did.
He had a great, great regular season, but like some of our other number 7s, had a rough game in the Super Bowl. The Dallas had the doomsday defense going, and they ended up with two defensive linemen were co-MVPs for the game because they were playing a game of let's meet at the quarterback.
Yeah, it's never a good day for a quarterback when they're playing that game, that's for sure.
No, it was Randy White and Harvey Martin, if I remember correctly. They were kind of
MVP. I think you're right. Well, okay, I think we have a pretty good collection of, we already said we're going to put the 7 Hall of Famers in. Now, just to review that, we have Morton Anderson, Dutch Clark, John Elway, George Halas, Mel Hine, Ace Parker, Ed Sprinkle, and Bob Waterfield. 7 Hall of Famers. We have those 7 locked up into our dozen greatest players of wearing the number 7 in NFL history. Now we have all these other ones, a lot of them quarterbacks, that to decide if we can come to some agreement who those other 5 names should be. Who would you think on your list? I mean, I've got a list of 5 that I'd want. I can go first if you want.
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to say Ben Roethlisberger, not only because of, you know, he plays for my team, but I think he's going to be probably a first ballot Hall of Famer when his name comes up after he retires.
No question.
And I'm going to, the other ones are going to be a little controversial and is debatable. I'm going to say Michael Vick as a number seven should be on the list because I think early in his career, his stats show that he was a truly great, substantial player. I'm going to say Boomer Esiason, Ron Jaworski, and Randall Cunningham. That rounds out my five that I think.
Yeah, I like that five. I think, you know, I'm an NFC East guy. I definitely got to go for Theismann. I like his style of play. I like that he played a few years in the CFL, returning punts, came to the NFL, you know, as a quarterback, and he was multidimensional. He could run, but he could throw. He made it to two Super Bowls. He won one of them. You know, he one of the most prolific offenses, the 1983 Redskins, you know, averaging almost 35 points a game. So, you know, I'm going to put a vote in there for Joe Theismann.
Okay, well, I can't debate that. Who do you think we should take off that between Roethlisberger, Vic, Esiason, and Jaworski, and Cunningham? Who would you take off that list to put Theismann in there?
I guess either Vic or Esiason.
That's who I'm thinking also.
One of those, you know, Esiason, he did have a couple of very, very high peak years, but, you know, those few, yeah, not that his fault, the Jets weren't a good team when he went there or the Cardinals, but, you know, it's his overall career losing record. But still, you know, he was part of an innovative offense there with Sam Weiss in Cincinnati. Michael Vick, I think of him more as a runner than a passer. I'm one of those two guys.
Okay, I mean, I guess you could go either way with that. I'm going to say probably, you know, I think you convinced me. I'm thinking I'm going to take Michael Vick off and put Theismann in there, but I think Vick is like a, you know, a 12A if we're talking a top 12 on mm-hmm. there. So you talked me into it. I agree with you. I think Theismann ought to be on that list. So, hey, just a review, we have Morton Anderson, Dutch Clark, John Elway, George Halas, Mel Hine, Ace Parker, Ed Sprinkle, Bob Waterfield, Ben Roethlisberger, Boomer Esiason, Ron Jaworski, Randall Cunningham, and Joe Theismann as our top 12 number sevens ever to win the game. That's the list that Larry Schmidt and I have come up with for this Pigskin Dispatch football by numbers. And Larry, we really appreciate your time and coming on again to talk with us. Before we let you go, do you have anything coming up that you want to talk about? Any projects you have with the Big Blue Interactive or with the Gridiron Uniform database that you got coming up that our listeners could take a look at?
Well, Bill and I we're always busy behind the scenes doing lots of research for the Gridiron Uniform database. We spent the last few days, he and I don't want to give away the surprise, but keep an eye on the early 1930s Bears. There's going to be a little bit of a makeover that might be a little surprising. It'll definitely be interesting for any fan, or any fans of 1930s football. You're going to see the Bears come up with a change. He and I have been working on that. And I'm just, you know, I'm working on my book slowly but surely.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well,
so
hey, when you
in writing, it's gonna take me a long time. It's gonna take a couple of years.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you were Bill, make sure you drop me a line when you put out your announcement on your findings. I'll be sure to share it on the podcast and on pigskindispatch.com website so that folks can be steered your way to take a look at that Gridiron Uniform database website to see what the surprise is.
Yeah,
I'm anxious now.
I'll let you know. It should be
okay.
Next week, I think.
All right. Well, Larry Schmidt, thank you once again for joining us. We really appreciate your time and for all the great research and history that you brought to us here on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It's always lots of fun.
It definitely is. Thanks, Larry.
Well, we have great thanks to offer to Larry Schmidt for once again joining us on a great discussion on the number seven jerseys. Hope you enjoyed that, and hopefully we'll have Larry on again. But we have some other great guests coming on to discuss football by numbers coming up. For the number 10s and 11s, we have Warren Rogan of the Sports Forgotten Heroes podcast you can find on the Sports History Network. Very interesting guy he is and great historian of sports. I think you'll really enjoy the number 10s and 11s with him. And for the number 12s, we have another great Sports History Network podcaster, and that's Dana Augister of the Historically Speaking podcast. And Dana brings some great insight to the great legends that wore the number 12 jersey, and I think you'll enjoy that too. And like I said, we have a lot of things coming up in the near future, and I think you'll enjoy. And don't forget, February 25th, we have our great interview with Upton Bell, the son of Burt Bell, the former commissioner of the NFL. And Upton has a great football resume to himself, too, in the NFL, as well as his grandfather. This family's been around football for ages, and I don't want to spoil anything for you, but I'm just telling you what, you don't want to miss it. February 25th, it's his father, Burt Bell's birthday, and what a better way to do it than to celebrate with his son, Upton, who has some great cherished moments to share with you about football history. So we'll wait till February 25th to have that one, but we have plenty of podcasts in between, so make sure you join us tomorrow. Hit that subscribe button, hit us up on pigskindispatch.com/podcast, or see us on the sportshistorynetwork.com, where you can see other great sports podcasts too on sports history, sportshistorynetwork.com. So till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.